and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. The Chicago Teachers Union is weighing a contract proposal, what a potential agreement could mean. Illinois officials say the state is losing more than $400 million in federal public health funding. A look at the impact it could have on disease prevention.
The Postal Service is ours. We're not giving it up without a fight.
And local postal workers are fighting job cuts and efforts to privatize, how it could affect the future of your mail delivery. And now to some of today's top stories. Members of the local transgender community are gathering on this year's Transgender Day of Visibility to push back on the Trump administration's policies.
Today, we honor the courage that it takes our trans community to live authentically in a world that is asking them and intimidating them into hiding. Our visibility is powerful. We will not hide. It is resistance. It is a declaration of our existence.
Advocates held a news conference today calling out President Trump's executive orders limiting trans people's access to sports and bathrooms, erasing mention of trans people on government websites and passports, and removing them from the military. Many of those moves are being challenged in court. Green Line riders may soon notice some construction at a West Side station. That's because a $25 million reconstruction project broke ground today at the line's Austin station in an effort to improve accessibility. The project includes the installation of a new elevator and escalator, a new ADA-compliant ramp, extension of the platform, and reconstruction of stairs. The main entrance of the station will be closed for construction starting in June and is expected to continue into next spring. The project comes amid broader funding uncertainty that transit officials say stands in the way of efforts to make all rail stations fully accessible by 2038. NASCAR says it'll put the pedal to the metal when setting up and tearing down this summer's street race. Officials say that process from start to finish will only take 25 days compared to 43 when the street race first began 2 years ago. Neighbors and some officials had complained in previous years about the race's impact on street closures, parking restrictions, and limited access to Grant Park. Pre-race activity starts June 16th with race weekend set for July 5th and 6th. And NASCAR is set to host a community meeting on Wednesday to share more information about the upcoming race. Details are on our website. Up next, the latest on a potential contract agreement for Chicago public school teachers, right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The Chicago Teachers Union could be close to making a contract deal. Union negotiators were set to meet today to consider a proposal from the district. It comes after almost a year of heated negotiations between the two sides. Our Matt Masterson joins us now with an update on the bargaining process. And Matt, you know, sort of bring us up to speed. What is the status of negotiations right now, and where are we in the process?
Yeah, so the union's big bargaining team, this is a few dozen members who helped negotiate this deal. They met today to consider a full set of proposals from CPS as part of this potential agreement. So you said it, this comes after a year. Negotiations started back in April of 2024. And it began smoothly, but they became quite contentious as things went on between union leadership and Chicago Public School CEO Martinez. Martinez, of course, was fired during the course of this, but will be allowed to remain on the job as a part of his stipulation and his contract for 6 months. There had been a few sticking points left out there about prep time for elementary school teachers and the school district's current teacher evaluation system, but it seems like the sides have reached agreements on those proposals. That's why this is now going to the bargaining team, and we could see some resolution as soon as this week.
If the bargaining team and the district do have a tentative agreement, then what would happen next?
Yeah, so the teacher's contract would not be finished just yet. The next step is that this would go from this bargaining team to the CTU's House of Delegates. This is the union's largest governing body, made up of about 700 members. That would happen on Wednesday. They would get to vote on it. If they approve of it, then it would go to the full union membership of 30,000 rank and file members, they would be have the final say on whether or not to ratify this contract. But even then, the deal is not yet official. That's everything from the union side, but then the contract would also have to be approved by the Chicago Board of Education. And of course, that's no longer just the 7-member mayorally appointed board, but now a 21-member partially elected body as well. So it once it gets through the board, once it gets through all those different union bodies, then this could be considered a done deal.
Not uncomplicated, of course. You mentioned a few, but what have been some of the major sticking points during this process?
Yeah, outside of those final points, the prep time, the teacher evals, pay obviously a main topic, but that was settled largely quite a bit ago. There has also been a push from the union for more librarians, a cap on class sizes, more protections for the employment for the teachers who have already been hired. And going back to November when President Donald Trump was elected, the union has begun pushing for what they say is basically a force field in this contract to prevent intrusion from the federal government, from Washington, any attacks on the most vulnerable students or teachers in the city as well. And they want this contract to be a part of that as well.
Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, we know that he also played a role in negotiations earlier this month when he called CTU President Stacey Davis Gates to his office, along with CPS CEO Pedro Martinez at City Hall. Did that meeting help to reach this deal, this potential deal?
Yeah, so there wasn't any immediate resolution after this. It's not like the sides all came together at that point. But Johnson did say that this was a productive conversation between the leadership. This was one of the first times he's really inserted himself into these conversations. In the days after CPS and the union, they did make what Johnson said was significant headway on those remaining sticking points after that conversation. So it wasn't the turning point in negotiations per se, but it was significant that he finally took a role in getting sides together for a conversation.
Yeah, some of us who've covered this a long time, we know, like, hopefully they're getting closer to a deal when they bring the heavies in at the end. Matt Masterson, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Matt's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. Illinois' public health funding is set to take a hit. State officials say the Trump administration is pulling back more than $400 million aimed at preventing infectious disease and treating mental health and substance abuse issues. The funding is part of roughly $1.8 billion the state is expecting to receive from the federal government, but remains in limbo. Joining us now with more are Dr. Kiran Joshi, Interim Chief Operating Officer of the Cook County Department of Public Health, and on Zoom, Dr. Samir Vora, director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Doctors, thanks to you both for joining us. Welcome back. Dr. Vora, I want to start with you, please. What do budget cuts of this size mean for your department, especially when the state of Illinois is already facing a tight budget year?
It is something that will create debilitating effects for the Illinois Department of Public Health and our public health community across the state of Illinois. This funding initially provided during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic was something that had been continued really to think about a few things: critical upgrades to our public health laboratories, improved technology to track infectious diseases, vaccination efforts, and really, as we found out during the COVID-19 pandemic, our ability to lean into strategies to prepare for future emergencies, all aspects that were provided for this federal funding, money that was provided to the state and our local health departments, really to protect Illinois residents from future and current public health emergencies.
Dr. Joshi, Cook County Health is losing two CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, grants totaling $31 million. What was that money to be used for?
Thanks, Brenda. So these funds are absolutely critical, per Dr. Vora's comments. We had one CDC grant that funded work around community health workers. These are lay people who often come from the very communities they serve, that is, extremely vulnerable communities, and play a crucial role in sharing health information, as well as providing us with an understanding of what's happening at the community level. So really, really critical work, Brandis. The other grant was a larger CDC grant that funded a variety of different activities, including things like increasing rates of pediatric vaccinations. I think it should be obvious to anyone who's watching at this time how important that is, particularly when we're seeing an outbreak of measles that is affecting communities across the country.
Cook County released a behavioral health workforce shortage report back in October, finding the state of Illinois doesn't have enough providers available to prevent, diagnose, and treat mental health and substance use disorders. How might these cuts impact the department's efforts to address some of that?
So behavioral health, quite simply, is public health and vice versa. So it's quite ironic that we're sitting here talking about cuts to public health funding when that report very clearly articulated that we needed tens of thousands more behavioral health workers to bridge the gap that we're currently experiencing. I mean, COVID really brought the behavioral health issues in our communities to light in a way that certainly we weren't aware of before.
Dr. Vora, the money was allocated for the next couple of years. What is at risk without these funds, and what recourse does the state have without them?
It is something that we knew and sort of had the expectation of in the Illinois Department of Public Health that we would have some more time to be able to spend this money thoughtfully and effectively. Now we are in a different sort of unique challenge of how do we continue to prepare? We have been very fortunate here in the state of Illinois through Governor Pritzker's leadership, where state funding has been invested in our public health work. But there's only so much that one state can do as we face these devastating federal challenges. The Illinois Department of Public Health are funding, our last fiscal year 25 budget had 65% of our funding coming from the federal government. This is not unique to Illinois. Many states have even more funding that comes from the federal government. With these cuts, very difficult for our state to work on it. What I can say is that we here at the Illinois Department of Public Health, with our partners, will use every single resource that we have available to our mission of protecting the health of our residents today and preventing future challenges tomorrow.
One of the things, Dr. Vora, that we've heard the White House say when making some of these cuts is that the pandemic is over. It's time for people to move on. What do you say to that? And how ready would you say the state is for the next public health emergency?
The COVID-19 pandemic, yes, is over. And I think we're all very happy about that. But I'd say, one, COVID is still around. We know that it's circulating in our communities. And we know that the challenge was not just with COVID-19, it was also sort of an understanding how can our public health community be better prepared for future emergencies. And that was something that we were continuing to spend this money in partnership with the federal government, using it effectively in ways that we could bolster our public health work, our labs, our vaccination efforts, technology to help protect us from future emergencies. We have been very much in the Illinois Department of Public Health with our partners thinking about different strategies, including a COVID-19 after action plan that was released in May 2024 that really talked about improving preparedness, modernizing our systems, improving our communications. We continue to put all of our resources and efforts around that important effort of protecting the state and our residents from future emergencies. But federal cuts like this will have some debilitating effects in order to make sure that we're using all of our optimal resources for that preparedness.
And Dr. Joshi, opioid overdose deaths in Cook County, you all have been able to finally see some of a bit of a decrease there, continuing to decline from their peak in 2022 down to 1,026 deaths last year. What does the department attribute this decline to?
Prentice, there are a number of factors that are at play here. I certainly think that the work that my colleagues at the Illinois Department of Public Health, the Chicago Department of Public Health, and ourselves have done in terms of distributing naloxone has certainly made a dent in what I could only characterize as a scourge. Now, there's also a sense that we've gotten in talking with our partners that there could potentially also be changes happening in the drug supply. So potentially less potent fentanyl, for example, being introduced in the drug supply, resulting in this downturn.
So it's less a matter of addressing folks who are suffering addiction. And there could be a number of factors, it sounds like, that are at play, including getting support to those folks who have addiction.
Absolutely, that's right. And in talking to our partners, we're also hearing just that, that it seems that more and more people are seeking treatment for addiction, which, again, is why we really need to be thoughtful about strengthening our public health systems, strengthening our behavioral health systems.
All right. That's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks to the work that for the work that both of you do and for joining us, Dr. Kiran Joshi and Dr. Samir Vora. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, how looming cuts could affect the mail system. The U.S. Postal Service has been facing challenges for years following the rise of the internet and subsequent decline in physical mail. The situation has recently gotten even more complicated. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, who is responsible for overseeing daily operations for the USPS, announced his resignation last week. It comes as the Postal Service says it's working with Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency to cut costs, including slashing 10,000 jobs. Joining us now with more on what it could mean for the future of the Postal Service and the potential impact on mail delivery are Melissa Rakestraw, Executive Vice President of the National Association of Letter Carriers Branch 825, and Michael Karaff, National Business Agent for the National Association of Letter Carriers Branch 11. Thanks to you both for joining us. We appreciate it. Melissa, let's start with you, please. There are some critics of the USPS. They want the service to be privatized or merged with the U.S. Department of Commerce. How do you think those changes would affect service?
Well, it would. We can look at the model from the Royal Mail in England. They privatized in 2013. It increased costs for mailers and consumers. It slowed down services and it increased pension obligations and the mismanagement of pension funds. So we could expect the same thing here.
Why do you think the same thing would play out here?
Because what they want to do is privatize the profitable aspects like parcel delivery and then leave the unprofitable aspects like letter delivery on the socialized government services. And there are over 51 million homes in the U.S. that are not serviced by any private carriers that the Postal Service would have to service. And the reason that private companies don't go there is because it doesn't make a profit.
Michael Karaff, if privatization were to happen, what would that mean for local customers, especially those who are in lower income or high crime areas?
Yeah, I mean, the two main things we'd be looking at would be higher costs and less service. So a private company, you know, Postal Service has a universal service mandate, meaning that we're going to go everywhere every day, no matter what it is. We deliver what we have and we take whatever the customer wants to put into the mail stream. And that universal service has served America for, well over 200 years. And if they start dismantling the network and selling off parts of the business and a private company would have to, come in, of course, they're going to go where it's more profitable. They're going to go where it's safe to go, to do so. Like, for example, there's some neighborhoods in Chicago. Amazon doesn't want to deliver the packages, they take it to the postal dock because why? Well, you know, it's a universal service mandate. So if you want to make sure that that service is going to be, you know, uniform, that everyone's going to receive the service, and you want to make sure that those costs are going to be equitable and you're not going to be gouged by a private company, then you have to have a public postal service.
At the same time, there have been, you know, complaints for years about the quality of service of USPS, Michael. And in an ideal world, what do you think USPS needs in order to stay afloat?
Yeah, I mean, there's some financial things. So first of all, the Postal Service doesn't receive any taxpayer money whatsoever. The whole network and the system and our salaries as letter carriers, everything is funded by postage, you know, the whole thing. So it's not like the Postal Service is a burden to anyone right now. It's just a service to the American people. You have a live person who's out in every community at least 6 days a week, and that live person, you're not paying for, your tax money is not paying for that. But while we're out there making our deliveries, we're also looking out for the people in the community. We run the largest food drive in America every year. We're big contributors to the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and we're out there, you know, if you're, you know, you want us to check on your grandmother or, you know, whatever, making sure the kids get to and from school, you know, that kind of thing. So the value of the Postal Service network is high, I think.
That said, Melissa, the service lost $6.5 billion in 2023, lost $9.5 billion in 2024. Is it possible to right the ship?
It absolutely is possible. You also have to have someone running the Postal Service that's interested in investing in it and having it thrive. This last quarter, the Postal Service did make a profit, but I think people should also keep in mind that this is a public service not designed to make profits. And we can actually offer more services to a lot of communities that may be underserved. There's been talks in the past about postal banking services, high-speed internet, solar panels on all of our buildings that could help feed into the electric supply in communities, charging stations for electronic vehicles in areas that don't have that. There's plenty of expansion of services that we could provide. And when you look over the last couple of years with Postmaster DeJoy, he was trying to simply push parcel delivery, and he slowed first class mail and increased prices, which caused us to lose some business. So those kind of things could be more whole for every consumer and not just focusing on the parcel delivery.
So it sounds like you think the agency could afford to think more creatively to support itself.
Absolutely. And in the past, we have seen the post office offer banking service for underserved communities. There are underbanked communities all across this country, whether it be in the city of Chicago or in more rural areas.
Michael, we just mentioned Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, but he's announced that he is stepping down. He's gone, yes. It's happened. Do you think leadership has done enough to bolster the agency? And are you concerned that, you know, in absence of this leadership, that the agency might suffer?
Yeah, we're pretty concerned about who will be taking over the helm of the United States Postal Service. I think that there are some things that are outside of the agency's control. There's some financial things, accounting things, dealing with the pension plans, how OWCP payments are calculated, that if you look at some of the things that Postmaster DeJoy was putting out prior to him leaving the agency, it was true. You know, those are things that through changes in law or things like that would help stabilize the finances of the Postal Service. But at the end of the day, the Postal Service has to reinvent itself as the delivery mechanism for America in the modern era. And that's not going to happen overnight, but I think it's well worth it to do that investment. Like right now, they're redoing the whole fleet. You know, the next generation delivery vehicle will be out there. It's an electric fleet. There's a lot of things that, and the Postal Service has to position itself to be able to deliver packages efficiently and quickly, you know, to the American people.
Everywhere.
Yeah, we've delivered everything all the time, right? Whatever comes into the mail stream, if the product of the future is going to be small packages, then we have to be able to deliver those small packages to the American people efficiently.
And we're almost out of time, but Melissa, you know, the Postal Service, it's older than the country itself is, and it's, you know, tied to our American identity and the stamps that sometimes people collect being sort of a, and it was once a symbol of career stability for many people to work as a postal worker. What do you think people are losing if we lose an institution like the Postal Service in about 20 seconds?
Oh, that's all?
No pressure.
So the Postal Service is part of the fabric of American community all across this country. We look out for our customers. We check on your grandparents. We check on people when they're on vacation. We're part of their home, you know, looking over their homes and that sort of thing. All across this country, we saw the expansion of roads and railroads to connect post offices. It was the original intranet. And it's going to continue to offer the services that modern-day internets need.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to you both, Melissa Rakestraw and Michael Kara, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And that is our show for this Monday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening, and you can catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Toni Preckwinkle announces she's running for a fifth term as Cook County Board President. She joins us to talk about her decision and challenges facing the county amid a second Trump administration. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to be a multilingual law firm that provides translators for a variety of languages.